So while the talk's been setting up, the interesting thing about the search for the transit of Venus is that it didn't only give us our place in the universe, it also helped to discover New Zealand. So that for some of us is very important, Captain Cook, so for some of us that's an important discovery. That's right. Great. Time is very important, and this is a wrong talk. Sorry about that. I need Sandner's talk. This is going to be a very interesting talk because I've never given it before, and Wolfgang sent it to me a few hours ago. Now, my own field of research is ultrafast science, and I've worked on some of the precursor technologies that will be I'll be talking about. But if there are any questions, I'd like them to be referred to a real expert, Professor Crowe, in the front row. So the subject of this talk is extreme light. I'll explain what that means in a while. But it's also about how the theme of light and creating a large facility can help to build an infrastructure and capacity within a number of European countries and eventually for the world. Now, we know that lasers have had a huge impact on society and the world through many different areas, through material processing. If your telephone, your cars, they're all cut. All those nice curves that you have in your hand are cut by lasers. We don't appreciate how widespread they are. The lasers also exist in other areas of the electromagnetic spectrum. There's a device called a maser, which is a microwave amplifier, which was actually invented before the laser. And it was the maser that was used, and which still is used, in microwave amplification, measuring cosmic microwave background. The very first experiments in 1965 were only possible to amplify the cosmic microwave background because of the invention of the laser 5 years before, the maser 5 years before. The question is, with all the successes of lasers that we've got, why do we need even bigger ones, right? So why do we need to make these giant lasers that push the power regimes into completely new frontiers of science? Well, the motivation is that if you want to invent any kind of new technology, and you want it to be new, the easiest way is to take the international system of units that we all know, meters lengths, meters for length, and seconds for time, and watts for power, and just do something that's a lot bigger or a lot smaller. And this is a great way to know that you're doing something new. And so if we can make more powerful lasers at shorter wavelengths, then we can probe smaller structures, and we can do new physics. So we're looking with this kind of extreme light of just pushing all the dimensionalities of lasers into new regimes. Shorter localized pulses of light, higher power. This can open up lots of frontiers, so we can generate new wavelengths such as X-rays, so rather than using the traditional techniques that have been known now for many years, over a century. We can also use the strong electromagnetic fields to accelerate charged particles, not using an RF process such as CERN with a long beamline, but just using a highly focused laser beam spot where the local electric field is sufficient to accelerate electrons. You can try to reproduce in the laboratory the same fusion conditions that occur in the center of the sun. And maybe you can even try to use these strong electromagnetic fields to induce pair production of particles from the vacuum. This is all extremely ambitious. The key to doing any of this, and this is really blue sky, is in building these ultra-high intensity, very short pulse lasers. Some key words that come back when you talk about ELI is the idea of attosecond pulses, which is 10 to the 18, and multi-petawatt powers going beyond the megawatt and the gigawatt and the terawatt, which is 10 to the 12, to 10 to the 15, 10 to the 18 watts. And if you focus those down to very short very small areas, you can get huge intensities. For the experts in the audience, these are some of the keywords that are the technologies that underlie ELI, but I'm not going to talk about those because each of those is an extensive talk in itself. What is interesting is just to consider how the evolution of ELI will change the parameters that are available to scientists. So if you look at the landscape of what you can do with a conventional laser, the vertical axis shows the available photon energy you can access with a conventional laser. The axis to the right shows the available intensity that we can access at the moment. And the axis coming out of the screen is the repetition rate, which tells you how many shots you have from your laser per second. So it's quite low. If you have 10 shots per second, it gives you a very poor signal-to-noise ratio. It's very hard to do experiments. With ELI, what the aim is to extend all of those parameters into completely new regimes, 3-4 orders of magnitude in photon energy and intensity, and an order of magnitude in repetition rate. So that's a huge increase for improving the accessibility and the usability of this technology. And if you can do this, then the new science is formidable in terms of the topics that you can now consider studying. Many of these research areas are underway, such as astrophysics and Max Planck Institute in Germany, plasma physics throughout Europe and especially in the large laboratories in the United Kingdom. The new studies of terahertz sources, which is particularly strong in France and Germany, and so on. So different countries in Europe have got expertise in all these areas. And of course, it's international. There are laboratories all over the world, Japan, China, United States, and elsewhere. The physics is on the left. On the right is what you can do. Now, there's nothing particularly new because we're already using lasers for most of these things, except perhaps the one right down the bottom. We're doing it, but we're just not doing it very well at the moment. But an increase in the power and pulse duration we can get from lasers will enable a lot of these areas, which are emerging applications, to really become useful, practical applications. It's long-term blue sky research. The applications will not be tomorrow. They'll be in 10 years at least, and maybe in the decades to come after that. But even building such an infrastructure to create extreme light takes decades. So it was 10 years ago when Europe took the decision building the extreme light infrastructure and the publication of the White Book, which formed the basis for the whole project. There are three defined components to the ELI infrastructure. One is called beamlines, the other is called ALPS, and the other is nuclear physics. So they focus specifically on generating high-energy ultra-short pulses, working on creating shorter pulses of nanosecond, 10 to the minus 18 seconds duration, and using the high intensity obtained from the lasers to do nuclear physics on a tabletop rather than using an accelerator. And there's a fourth ultra-high field facility which is still being considered. Now, the timeline of the plan to build this is rather interesting. What I find most interesting about this is that the it's a lot shorter than building CERN, for example, precisely because the infrastructure is above ground. There's no tunnel drilling to go on. So that's a significant advantage. It began back in 2005, 2006, with the European Science Forum for Research Infrastructure just discussed the possibility of an extreme light infrastructure. Then funding for a preparatory phase was obtained just to get the partners together, talking to each other, doing the case studies and so on. And it was in 2011 where the construction of the three main pillars of ELI began with the aim being in 2018 to have the combined operation of these three components. Now, when you talk to Wolfgang Sandner about how this plan is going, he always says four words: on time, on budget. Right? And he constantly insists that this is running extremely well. So, speaking of the budget, the preparatory phase, that was the test of whether this concept was workable, both within the scientific community, asking the question, do scientists really want to work together on such a facility? And it's worthwhile pointing out that that perhaps isn't an obvious, the answer to that question isn't an obvious yes, because many scientists, such as myself, who chose a career in laser science, did so precisely because we didn't have to work in a large team, because you could run your own laboratory, you could do your own experiments on a bench. And sacrificing that autonomy to work in a large infrastructure is different. It's a difficult decision. So the scientific gains had to be worth that personal choice to work in a much larger distributed team. So you're talking around about a billion euros in total from the initial phase to the implementation of it and the projected budget for operation. So this is a photograph from a few weeks ago in Szeged, where you can see the buildings are well underway. This is what it will look like. I love these artists' photographs. It's always sunny and blue skies. But at least we see that Hungary, as far as I know, is always sunny and blue skies. So I think this is quite accurate. This is the building in the Czech Republic, recently opened. And this is the construction in Romania a few months ago as well. And so the construction of these facilities is proceeding precisely according to plan. Now, the aim here is to create a CERN-like model for high-intensity laser physics. And I think the scientific opportunities are really fantastic. And there's a very famous quote from the inventor of the laser, the Nobel laureate, Charles Townes, where he wrote in his book, Adventures of a Scientist, How the Laser Happened, that at the time the laser was invented, it was invented to provide a coherent source of high flux, when the maser was invented, it was invented to provide a coherent flux of microwaves so that Charles Townes and his group could do microwave molecular science, to study microwave transitions. And he said the applications in laser cutting, welding, medicine, communications were not at all his motivation. And I think we have to view a project like ELI in that spirit, where we're studying something very interesting for its own sake, and the applications that perhaps will be the most useful of such extreme light might be nothing at all like the ones that were put up in the initial case to make it. And they may tell us something completely different and completely new, and I think that's what's most exciting of all. So thank you very much. I'm perfectly comfortable in saying I don't know the answer to the question.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a laser light researcher myself, so I accept the answer if it would be that. But you had very intriguing word on the slide that fusion might be possible to achieve it with this LE structure. So in America, we have this national ignition facility. Why and how would be ELE better than that one?
Okay, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe there is an expert in laser fusion who can answer this. I think that the smart answer is to say because it's funded, right? Because they've stopped the funding to the NIF. Right? Congress has removed it because it wasn't setting the targets. But I don't know the technical answer. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Someone else can answer that. Okay.
No, I can just answer to the question. Actually, NIF is mainly one experiment with fusion, and ELI is having different kind of lasers, so actually shorter ones, and should be helping to prepare, some experiments we performed on NIF. So some parameters that NIF are still not known, and that's why the fusion experiment didn't succeed as much as it should have been. So you can, for example, test some models on ELI, which then will be useful for being implemented in NIF. So that's the link between both facilities. But ELI has been conceived as an experimental facility for experiments and applications, whereas NIF is an almost closed facility only devoted to fusion. Okay.